local elections, of course, Kate Canlis being the DA.
Uh-huh. That helps.
All right. And I think it needs to be said, too, in an objective sense, if we're going to play this kind of politics where we condemn and we make statements about on the national level, let's bring it on back home to Santa Cruz. Okay? I think it's important for the so-called progressives, and that includes Scott Kennedy. Right? Let's talk about the local issue in the same context to which you are talking about the broad issues.
I hear you. Well, thank you, Bob.
Local application of values. Robert, thank you.
Bob, you mentioned that a moment ago that you want to see some changes in the Citizens Police Review Board and how they're dealing with issues. I know that on Sunday, the Happy John Dine Memorial, the third anniversary of the slaying of Happy John Dine is happening, and of course the day after, the Citizens Police Rubber Stamping Board, as I call it, CPRB, meets with a lot of lame duck members. I guess four people will be changing their seats. Not that it makes a lot of difference, because the three most activist members, I don't think, have shown that strong a willingness. Well, they've shown a lack of willingness to deal with these issues of, you know, whether it's lethal force by the police, or open investigations, or subpoenaing officers and having public hearings, or pepper spray local. I mean, you can name the issue. They have not been there. But you yourself are developing a new interest in this issue?
Well, this came out of your indicating, you're showing that when the CPRB was going to review themselves under closed session, in fact, you called me on that, Robert, back in February, I believe it was. And it was because of you and Mr. Norris that they had to come above board with their attempts to what I think what they were attempting to do was to shelve it completely. I think what might have happened last summer, had it not been for you, Robert, was that the CPRB would be dismantled.
Well, you know, it's interesting that they have only held one meeting of that committee, the Citizens Police Review Board City Council Subcommittee, which is supposed to represent, I should say, recommend strengthening amendments for the CPRB. And Leff has repeatedly, he's the chair of that committee, postponed such meetings and also misled people about its happening soon, which is something he's done throughout the last 2 years on the CPRB as chair. And he earned my opposition to his candidacy for city council for that reason. But yeah, on Monday, I guess there's some stuff happening, and or maybe, I don't know, stuff happening. They're having their board meeting.
I think in terms of being near the proximity of the John Dine shooting anniversary, that it's important that there be a strong showing at the CPRB meeting in that regard. Mm-hmm. I think that we can see similarities, and I want to put them on the same plane, but certainly similarities between the Warren report and the report that was issued in the John Dine shooting, mm-hmm. which was accessible at the library for a while after the investigation settled. It was about an inch and a quarter thick.
Mm-hmm.
And only a quarter inch of that, inch and a quarter, was relevant. The rest of it was the kind of drugs that Dine was on. Irrelevant stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of the things that Garrison brings up about, Jim Garrison, about the Warren Commission report, is that Jack Ruby's mother's dental record is in there. Why?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, even if Ruby had bit Oswald, it's irrelevant. Well, an inch out of that inch and a quarter report on John Dine, in my opinion, and others, is irrelevant.
And for those who are interested, that report may well still be in the library. You should ask the reference desk if the Happy John Dine report is there. In fact, I will probably make that inquiry myself tonight.
We forget about the statements about combat stands, 15-hour later summary judgment. This went down very fast, and I think we need to use this as an example. John Dine shooting, minimum what happened during that event, that incident, was that the police did not follow proper procedures. That needs to be said over and over again. This was sloughed off. This was put under the table. And we're supposed to forget about it and move on to the next puff piece. I feel sad maybe cynical. I think that the CPRB, it's based in a good concept. It's based upon the idea that we need an outside agency to examine police behavior, and that's where it came about. Certainly the John Dine incident was an example where the CPRB did not rise to the occasion. One other thing I want to say about the Citizens Police Review Board, like other agencies, they have the power to proclaim. And they can use this or not use it, just like the Santa Cruz City Council proclaims Tibet stuff and all this, and more power to them. But in instances like police abuse of power, the CPRB should rise to the occasion here locally in Santa Cruz, and not just in the city but in the county. People listen to what they say.
Right.
It's important that people feel that their government is other than rubber stamping the bureaucracies that are in power and entrenched.
And for those who are interested, the CPRB does meet Monday on November 13th at 5:30 at City Council Chambers. We've been talking with Bob LaMonica.
One last thing, Robert.
Mm-hmm.
If not that his ashes were scattered at sea, John Dine's body would be moldering in the grave.
Hey, thank you very much, Bob.
Robert, thank you.
His body moldering in the grave, but his spirit marching on, hopefully, at least in the hearts of some of us. That was Bob LaMonica, rent control advocate, who will be doing a debate in December in San Jose on the issue, and I'm hoping that I can either be there or get access to that debate to play it here on Free Radio. The Citizens Police Review Board meeting and the Happy John Dine Memorial both happened as scheduled, and that was a week ago, actually. That was last week. Today is the... Happy John Dine Memorial was on the 12th, and that was a week ago. Today is the 19th. We had a small but persistent group of people starting on Pacific Avenue who eventually went to the place where Happy John was shot by Officer Connor Carey at the bus station, or bus stop, I should say, right across from the New Leaf parking lot at Front and Soquel Streets, on Front Street, actually. Beautiful chalking on the sidewalk done, a little memorial kind of grave tombstone chalked on the little brick wall there. Some good speeches, one particularly by Daniel Garcia talking about the murder of his brother by San Francisco police officers, Mark Garcia. A little police interference seemed apropos. They told us we were talking too loud. Danny Garcia waved it off and kept talking, and police went away. This is during the day. We're talking about, the early evening of Sunday evening is a time downtown where there is a certain latitude and should be for these public issues. There has to be that latitude. And I hopefully will be giving you some tape on that issue. I'm, as usual, behind in getting my tapes together, and I apologize to all of you out there for that. If anybody wants to volunteer to help the show, however, I encourage you to give a call to 423-HUFF. 423-4833. You could definitely use some people to catalog the tapes, to assist in getting a better technical proficiency on these tapes, and kind of we are really doing it by the skin of our teeth. I get a lot of help from Becky Johnson, who really rushes in to fill the gaps, but she's only one person, and we need a staff of 50, so give us a call at 423-HUFF if you want to be part of that winning team, the dream team. If you want to talk on the air, we do have lines open here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. 96.3 FM is our broadcasting location. The phone number here is 427-3772. And a couple of stories which I haven't had time to read, I'm going to kind of catch up on them from the internet and from the local papers. San Francisco Chronicle, last month, a homeless man found beaten near BART dies. Homeless man has died after being found beaten near the Ashby Berkeley BART station earlier in the week, police said yesterday. Merlin Terry Antone, 42, was taken off life support Wednesday night at Highland Hospital, where he had been taken Sunday when a passerby found him beaten near Adeline Street and Martin Luther King Jr. Way, said Berkeley Police Lieutenant Russ Lopes. No motive has been established and no arrest has been made, Lopes said. San Francisco, some 200 volunteers will hit the bricks, the doorways, the parks, and the underpasses tonight. I guess that's the end of October, as San Francisco undertakes the second census this year of its homeless population. This first such count in the city for the 2000 census, undertaken in May by about 150 counters, proved to be controversial. Advocates for the homeless charged that the count of 4,100 in San Francisco was far too low. The city, which spends about $60 million a year on homeless services, defended last spring's count as a good start towards dealing with one of San Francisco's most vexing problems, and says tonight's census will be even better because of the larger number of counters. Without waiting for tonight's tally, the two sides have not changed their minds. With more volunteers, we'll find more people, and with more homeless volunteers helping, finding places where people congregate, we'll find more, said George Smith, the city's homeless coordinator, who until a few years ago was homeless himself. That's new to me. On the other side, Paul Bowden of the Coalition on Homelessness charged that tonight's count is a farce. Their numbers are not realistic, Bowden said. Anyone who spent a week working in homeless programs knows this count is totally irrelevant. Tonight's plan is for volunteers, mainly city workers on their own time. This was actually 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Employees of nonprofit service agencies, neighborhood activists, and church volunteers to fan out at 9 p.m. In teams of two or three, they will go into all 11 of the new supervisorial districts and count people they see sleeping outside in doorways, parks, freeways, vacant lots, or other hideaways. The count should be done by midnight. All the teams will be in touch by cell phone with the operations headquarters of the Department of Public Health building at 101 Grove Street. The city will also take a census of the 1,500 places in its homeless shelters and check with San Francisco General Hospital and other health facilities on the number of patients registered who do not have permanent home addresses. May's final count of 4,100 included 1,805 people on the streets, plus the same number in shelters. The city later added people in hospitals, treatment programs, or those, quote, marginally housed, which means sleeping in someone's garage or other temporary lodging. Smith said the census in May produced a few surprises that have helped shape city policy. For instance, many homeless people spend their days in residential neighborhoods and then head downtown because that is where shelters and other services are. That's why we're looking at more neighborhoods to provide services there and to keep people connected and prevent them from becoming homeless. He pointed to the scheduled opening next month, the city's latest drop-in center for the homeless in the Bayview District. There will be showers, lockers, voicemail, and a kitchen for hot meals. The city has also opened a storage facility on Otis Street in the Mission District where people can store their belongings rather than pushing them around in shopping carts. It has also expanded the mobile assistance patrols to serve homeless families. I believe those may also be the patrols that take you into custody for mental health problems, but I could be wrong about that. Bowden of the Homeless Coalition said the snapshot census greatly undercounts the homeless, whose numbers he puts at 12,500, citing earlier city estimates. Bowden said the census, which is modeled after similar counts in Boston and other U.S. cities, is a publicity stunt. The advantage of the city to say to the media that we're doing something is ego-driven. But Smith said he is increasingly confident the city is getting a more accurate count and that officials can focus more on long-term solutions. These include leasing low-priced hotels and turning them into supervised transitional housing to provide residents with medical care, social workers, organized activities, and crisis intervention. But where is rent control? Actually, there's a little bit of rent control in San Francisco. And then there was a second story on the subject. It looks like, as I said, I tend to agree with Paul Bowden. If they're getting 4,000 people for a population of, I thought it was more like 14,000 to 16,000 homeless in San Francisco, they are undercounting big time. And, of course, that feathers their nests of the social service providers who say, look at what a great job we're doing. A shopping cart or sleeping bag counts as one person. A tent or a car counts as two people. Those were the rules as 100 volunteers fanned out through San Francisco last night to conduct the second census of homeless people. And again, I seem to be reading a press release for an activity that really is sort of a publicity stunt. So I'm going to pass this one on. Anybody interested in hearing it, of course, can call up and I will perhaps oblige you. What else have we got here? Some articles about Los Angeles and the LAPD. Lots of interesting stuff coming over the internet on that issue, and or in the LA, at the LA Times on their website. LA has recently convicted 3 of 4 police officers, the first of the bunch of the Rampart corruption morass that were charged with things like obstructing justice, perjury, planting evidence, and so forth. And that, frankly, is quite reassuring, particularly since the prosecution did a miserable job. They didn't present the main police officer who turned tail on the cops, who blew the whistle on the and broke the code of silence and the thin blue line. His name was Perez. But even though he wasn't testifying, you know, the jury didn't believe the cops. They believed the gang members, who were the other people who testified. It was really quite impressive. Ottawa homes, not bombs, 37 found not guilty. On November 6th and 7th of this year, 37 of the original 54 people who were arrested last November 12th, interesting date, that was Happy John Dine's slang here in Santa Cruz in 1997, and this is up in Canada, were found not guilty. 4 had been released without charges. 13 had chosen to plead guilty. There was an effort to continue the spirit of protest into the courtroom. From the very beginning, when pleas such as I plead for peace and justice, I plead for the 49 people who froze to death on the streets of Ottawa were given instead of pleas of guilty or not guilty, An effort was made by the defendants and their witnesses to keep the attention focused on the issues of war and homelessness that led to the protest. And it's a good strategy. In fact, I may use it if I decide to plead not guilty in this case I'm facing in San Jose, which comes to court, I think it's in a week and a half. And that was the San Jose Community Homeless Alliance Ministry. We all went up to the mayor at city council and said, you have to address these issues and deal with the crisis out there on the streets. And the mayor just sort of, you know, who had refused to meet with any of us for, well, ever since he got into office several years before, he agreed to have a representative meet with us, but he wouldn't meet with us himself and he wouldn't propose any specific solutions. So we simply stayed in the city council chambers and the police arrested us as we stood at the mic, although we weren't blocking other people from going to the mic. And then we, a number of people had a jury trial recently, as I talked about a week or two ago. They were found guilty, but they didn't, I don't know if they used this fine idea of saying, I plead frozen, I plead dying on the street, whatever, that the apparently the Ottawa Homes Not Jails people used, and apparently successfully used. Maybe the people up there just have more of a sensibility, maybe it's colder, maybe it's not Silicon Valley. Maybe the folks in the first bunch of protesters down here in San Jose got a bad jury, because there are three groups. I'm in the second group. It looks like we're all going to plead out, provided we can do so without getting probation, which is the deadly conditional chain that the system uses. If you are on probation and you then do a protest, you can be taken into custody, charged with... if they can... cook up anything that looks like it might be considered a violation of the law, even a peaceful violation of the law. You don't even need to be given a jury trial, and you don't get the benefit of the usual standard beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just 51% preponderance of the evidence, and they can revoke your probation and send you to jail for a year, depending on the term of your probation and the original term of your sentence. So it's not an easy thing for people to do, to consider to accept that probation. Some activists locally have done so because they want to get on with their lives, but they've done so reluctantly. Anyway, continuing this story, Ottawa Homes Not Bombs. Keeping with the spirit of open nonviolence, a statement of facts was agreed to by both the Crown and the defendants. In Canada, it's the Crown. This statement stressed that the protest was nonviolent, did not contest any of the identities of the 37 accused, and included an admission that the arrested either sat on the sidewalk or were charged with obstructing police, or sat on the roadway and were charged with mischief. The Crown's focus was on whether or not the accused had been told to leave the area, with a lesser focus on the length of time of the protest, over an hour and a half during a Friday rush hour. The defense focus was on the motivations for the action. The actions during the lead-up to the protest was a key part of the defense, from informing the Ottawa Transit of the protest weeks in advance to efforts to arrange for a meeting with Defense Minister Art Eglinton. The weeks of preparation were stressed in an effort to indicate that there was ample opportunity for Ottawa officials to arrange to deal with the protest. The police admitted that they were very much aware of the protest, indeed that two undercover officers had attended a non-violence training session prior to the action. Defense witnesses also stressed their background, from working with the homeless to working on human rights campaigns to personal experiences with poverty. The defense also relied on three cases, Regina v. Behrens, Regina v. Birch, and Regina v. Hiscox. These three cases involved criminal charges arising from nonviolent protests, the Queen's Park plant-in May Day on Bay and the Gulf protest that included sitting in front of Mike Harris's campaign bus during the last provincial election. In all these cases, the accused were acquitted and limitations suggested on the use of the criminal code to deal with nonviolent dissent. Boy, I think we should all move up to Ottawa the way this is looking. Judge Fontana took a great deal of time in reaching his decision. He claimed that it was a particularly unique demonstration, very well organized, and thoroughly prepared for the use of nonviolent means of protest. The methods used by the protesters were ones employed to communicate a message. They were imaginative in that they communicated concerns without resorting to violence, without resorting to force, said Judge Fontana. The judge made positive reference to the three cases, but most directly to Regina versus Hiscox and, to a lesser extent, Regina versus Behrens. The judge felt that the principles outlined in these cases by the judges in coming to their decisions were ones that should be followed, especially examining the limits of tolerance for political actions before they are perceived as criminal wrongdoing. The judge declared that he was not bound by those cases, but was persuaded by them on the basis of the cases presented, and due to the peaceful nature of the protest, the charges were dismissed. And that is good news up in Canada. And I admit that a lot of those references may be obscure to you. They're obscure to me. But what isn't obscure is that a lot of people were found not guilty, and that apparently the boundaries of a nonviolent protest were expanded even further by this kind of decision. And perhaps the reason we're finding this is here's another story from Canada. Homeless deaths predicted on Toronto's streets. This promises to be a grim winter for homeless people in Toronto, according to a report prepared by the Toronto Disaster Relief Committee. There will definitely be an increase in the death rate if something isn't done, said TDRC co-founder Kathy Crow. Crow is a street nurse who's worked with homeless people for the past 13 years. She doesn't expect to see any quick solutions. 35 homeless men and women were known to have died so far this year in metropolitan Toronto. The TDRC report, State of the Disaster, Winter 2000, is described by the organization as a street-level snapshot of the situation in Toronto. The TDRC uses information gathered from shelter workers, homeless advocates, and homeless people themselves to argue for more beds, more shelters, and more money. Disastrous situation. It attacks the city and provincial governments for failing to respond to a crisis. The Toronto City Council voted to declare it a national disaster 2 years ago. On any given night, there are 6,000 people using shelters and at least 1,000 more sleeping outside, says Crow. You can't walk along a city street without seeing homeless people sleeping. It's scandalous and depressing. 2 points relevant to us in Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz City Council has 3 times declared a shelter emergency, in 1990, in 1995, and in 1998. In 2000, the census needs assessment found the massive number of homeless people, even 2 or 3 times would have been counted in 1990. City and countywide. Yet, there has been not a pinch of expansion of the shelter situation or an ounce of decriminalization of the right of homeless people to shelter themselves and to sleep. That is to say, the sleeping ban remains in force and the camping ban remains in force. It remains illegal even to fall asleep or cover up with a blanket, much less to put up a tent in a park when it's raining and you have a family out there in the cold, or to sleep in your car. All these things are illegal in Santa Cruz in spite of 3 times declared shelter emergencies in Santa Cruz. Secondly, this report has power because in these urban areas, very urban areas, as in Toronto, you can see people sleeping on the streets. This is one of the reasons that homeless activists are proposing decriminalization of the sleep situation, this ending the sleeping ban. They believe, we believe, I believe, it will result in more people being visible. And this, of course, makes middle-class people who are opposed to this squeamish. You're letting them sleep on our streets. You know, that's something the neighborhoods can't tolerate, is what they say. Or alternately, this is a bad solution to homelessness. It's no solution to let them sleep on the streets. The truth of the matter is, however, when more people are seen, there is significantly more pressure to do something about them in a real way. This was what was found in Miami and Fort Lauderdale and in Eugene when sleeping bans were lifted or homeless sleeping was partially decriminalized in both those cities. And I'd also like to point out that I have received no reports from Austin or Eugene, 2 cities where the sleeping / camping bans, it's the sleeping ban in Austin and the camping ban in Portland, not in Eugene, were overturned. And none of those areas have I heard about a magnet effect happening. So I thought I'd throw that one in too, the Mike Rotkin boogeyman magnet effect. In any case, we're reading about a story about Toronto and the disaster that is impending there. The TDRC, Toronto Disaster Relief Committee, estimates that there's a shortfall of 1,000 beds in the city and the available shelters are overcrowded and home to disease, violence, and theft. And the report's authors sum up their findings in a 4-word solution: open more shelter beds. Of course, we also need affordable housing and decent jobs and at higher wages, living wages even. The report itself paints a disturbing picture of life on the streets. Most homeless people have experienced difficulty in trying to find a bed, and those with mental or addiction problems find it even harder. They are often barred from shelters. It's estimated that 20% of shelter users have both addictions and mental health problems, but only 2% of available beds are set aside for them in Toronto. The realities of street life. People who do get into shelters are faced with poor food and a bed that is often just a mat on the floor. Almost always the case in Santa Cruz, by the way. Jammed between other bodies. Toilets are few and often overflowing. Showers are rare. Bedding is dirty and contributes to the spread of lice and disease, and the crowded conditions guarantee that infectious diseases spread throughout the homeless community. They also raise tensions in a population where violence is a daily fact of life. All residents of shelters have witnessed violence. Most have been victims or perpetrators. And whether in the shelters or on the streets, even the meager belongings of a homeless person are the target of thieves. Money, medication, clothing, and food have to be guarded 24 hours a day. And the loss of an item like a sleeping bag can mean the difference between life and death in Toronto. For some, the difficulty of getting into a shelter and the conditions inside make sleeping in the streets preferable, even in winter. But some don't have a choice. The TDRC reports that approximately 2,500 parents with children are currently living in Toronto shelters. That's more than double the number of 5 years ago. Homeless children. Every week since January 1999, 100 more children have entered the shelter system. These are families that have exhausted all other options, living with families, friends, in subsidized housing. Most end up living in one room in cheap motels. The TDRC calls for the immediate opening of enough beds to eliminate the shortfall before winter begins. In the longer term, it wants all levels of government to spend 1% of their budgets on solving the homeless problem. That's about $2 billion nationally in Canada. It would allow the opening of more and better equipped shelters, including housing for those with mental and addiction problems. We're hopeful there will be more money in the federal spring budget, said Kathy Crowe, but we need more shelters before the cold weather. Something has to be done. When asked what will happen if they can't get the city to make more beds available, she says she doesn't know. We'll have to take a more severe strategy because things will have to happen. Maybe some of the empty buildings will have to be taken for the homeless. And, of course, it's been proposed that buildings like the Rex Court, slated for demolition, be taken over by homeless people now, both as shelter and also to save the housing, because that demolition process undertaken as part of the Mercy Charities Housing Dolphin Lee project that has been rammed through the council has been done without the benefit of a building inspector's written report, without the benefit of red tagging, without the benefit of a cost comparison. They're destroying housing in Santa Cruz and the beach flats, supposedly in order to save and increase housing. A strange situation. And here's a story from England. In England, there is evidence that a number of homeless people would prefer to sleep rough than live in a hostel, especially the long-term homeless. There are a number of reasons, and the reasons vary from person to person. People want to stay with their friends and stay up late drinking and talking. Many hostels are dry hostels, no alcohol on the premises, and no one who is very drunk. This means if you are an alcoholic, you don't want to last from 7:30 p.m. to 7:30 a.m. without drinking. In the summer, it's cheaper to sleep rough than pay the hostel fees. Some hostels have very poor standards indeed. People feel it is almost cleaner to sleep rough, and to sleep rough, of course, means to sleep outside. Some hostels can be very intimidating, either because of the type of resident they attract or because of the layout or staffing. Some people feel it is safer to sleep on the streets. At least in the doorway, you are protected on three sides. You just have to watch the fourth. Or you can sleep in the same doorway or car park with people you trust. A lot of homeless people have dogs. Very few hostels in England allow clients and their pets to stay. The cold weather shelters and Christmas shelters in England, especially London, have a much better record, but they have far less rules. People sleep in big rooms on mattresses on the floors, but can drink in some shelters and they can take their dog to other shelters. This is according to Megan Ravenhill. We have an incoming call, which gives me an opportunity to rest my voice. Hi, you're on free radio.
Yeah, one more thing to include, I'll leave it short, is people that have problems with other people in the shelter,
mm-hmm.
either financial or personal.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big issue in a lot of the shelters.
Yeah, I hear you. Plus, of course, there's a problem of disease. You know, you're often afraid, sometimes justifiably, that you're going to pick up something communicable because everyone's crammed in the same room.
Absolutely. All right.
Thank you. And we're going to be reading some more of these interesting stories, which I've kind of been piling up over the weeks because I haven't had an opportunity to read them. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, in case you've forgotten, 96.3 FM. Call-in number for those who don't have it is 427-3772, 427-3772. Our phone lines are open, and let's take a breather.
Bum-ba-doo-da-doom. Trade that's free Bum-ba-doo-da-doom. Is what it's supposed to be. Not slavery in sweatshops and prisons, factories, poison the water, land and trees, are sold to the slaughter. Corporate greed is trampling human need. Food and seed a twisted for profit. We've sold the part that once was the heart of local economy. Industry, why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you? Take our jobs, we want to lose them. Send them south where you can abuse them. Your goodbye left me with kids that cry. How can I parent here without you? Free trade tore apart that once was the heart of our community.
Again, another selection from This Time with Feeling, American Parody. Here's a story from Salt Lake City, Frank Carreri, the Salt Lake City Tribune, Saturday, November 11th. People living on the streets of Salt Lake City are not yet clamoring to get into homeless shelters despite the week's snow and sub-freezing temperatures. Up to 6 inches of snow fell in Salt Lake City on Thursday, and temperatures reached a chilling low of 28 degrees early Friday morning, probably about as cold in Santa Cruz on some of these nights, according to the National Weather Service. But of the 2,000 to 3,000 homeless people in the Salt Lake area, only about 555 sought beds at shelters, said Pamela Atkinson, vice president of Mission Services, a local group that helps impoverished people. That left at least 320 beds unclaimed at shelters in Salt Lake City and Midvale. Atkinson said she had expected more homeless people to flock to the shelters, but a lot of the men just told me they were going to continue to camp out because they like their freedom. Many have stayed away so they could arrive early to stand in line at a temporary job placement agency, Atkinson said. Lines sometimes begin forming around 5 a.m., and those in the front often stand a better chance of getting work. Several agencies have handed out warm clothing, blankets, and sleeping bags to many homeless people who are braving the cold, she said. However, Atkinson said many homeless men who skipped the shelter have told her that if it gets much colder, they may come in. A more intense cold front and significant snowfall could engulf the Wasquatch front by Tuesday or Wednesday, bringing temperatures in the mid-teens, the National Weather Service reported. And here's a story from Rhode Island, dated November 14th. Panelist urges public to give to street beggars. Catherine Rhodes tells a Brown and RISD audience that people fall victim to stereotypes about the homeless and assume panhandlers are nothing but drunks, by Randall Richard, a Providence, Rhode Island Journal staff writer. To Catherine Rhodes, who went from being homeless to being an eloquent advocate for those who remain on the streets, the answer to the bigger question, what to do about homelessness, isn't easy. But to the question posed last night at a panel discussion on panhandling, to give or not to give, the answer, she says, is simple. Give, Rhodes said, and give as much as you can, and let God worry about the rest. All too often, she says, people fall victim to stereotypes about the homeless and assume that panhandlers are nothing but drunks looking for enough money to buy another bottle of booze. For one thing, Rhodes said, it's just not true, and quoting one homeless man who once conceded that I drink because when they kick me, it doesn't hurt so hard, called on the public to avoid being too judgmental. Rhodes was one of five panelists, including three former homeless people, who discussed the issue last night, November 14th, at a meeting of the Brown University Rhode Island School of Design Hillel Foundation. All five panelists agree that panhandling, for the vast majority of those who practice it, is usually undertaken only as a last resort, and that people who might be reluctant to provide a helping hand should not fall victim to stereotypes. The unfortunate reality, Rhodes said, is that many people who are homeless are too proud to beg at all and have resigned themselves to suffering in silence. But whether a homeless person begs or not, she says, society has an obligation to do whatever it can to help ease the pain. Rhodes note that people who have been forced to beg throughout history in virtually every society. What seems to be different today, she suggests, is that those of us who live in the richest country in the world either no longer want to put up with people who beg or, quote, almost want to criminalize, unquote, the practice. Rhodes said that one of the state's biggest problems is that there is simply not enough affordable housing. Rents in Providence, Rhode Island, she says, have skyrocketed over the years, even forcing people with minimum wage jobs onto the street. Rhodes says that contrary to popular belief, as many as 90% of the people in the homeless shelters throughout the state have jobs. They just don't have enough money, she says, to pay rents of $600 or $700 and still feed their families. Ever since the Reagan administration, when the federal government started getting out of the business of building affordable housing, she says minimum wage workers have found they are paying as much as 80 to 90% of their incomes for rent. What happens, she says, is that they soon must choose between eating or paying the landlord, and when they fall far enough behind on their rents, they and their children end up in the street. Rhodes said this homelessness is inexcusable at a time when the nation is enjoying huge government surpluses. That's Randall Richard, Providence, Rhode Island Journal staff writer's story. Panelist urges public to give to street beggars. And contrastingly, in England, here's a story from a month before from The Guardian, October 9th. Don't give cash to street beggars, public urged. Patrick Wintour writes, the government is to spend nearly £250,000 on a pre-Christmas advertising campaign urging the public not to give cash to beggars. The campaign strengthens the message of the Rough Sleepers Unit to encourage the genuinely homeless into hostels rather than surviving on the streets where they're more likely to be prey to drugs and alcohol abuse. Research shows that the longer the homeless spend on the streets, the more difficult it is to encourage them back into work and society. The Department of the Environment, Transport, and the Region said that the adverts planned for newspapers would not be instructing people to turn down appeals for cash from beggars, but would urge them to give help in kind, such as blankets or food or clothing. The text still being drafted might suggest as an alternative that Christmas goodwill take the form of donations to or voluntary work for charities for the homeless. The Rough Sleepers Unit, part of the DETR, Department of the Environment, drew up the proposals after a report from the Cabinet Office's Social Exclusion Unit in 1998. A DETR official said, we want to make sure that people who receive help are genuinely homeless, but many people begging on the streets are really trying to feed a drug habit. She admitted that the government had not undertaken a scientific study to estimate the number of beggars who are genuinely homeless, but most came from institutional backgrounds such as care homes or the army. She said homeless charities had been consulted about the advert. The contract for the campaign had been given to the Leith Advertising Agency, but everything was still at the planning stage. Rory Gilbert, deputy executive of The Big Issue, one of the organizations consulted by the unit, criticized the plan. Telling people what to do in this way is ridiculous. Often people who are begging are not actually homeless. Not giving to them does not help people off the streets. However, Alex Hughes, the Salvation Army's territorial commander in the UK, broadly supported the campaign as the only way for people inclined to be generous to avoid having their money spent on drugs or drink. The unit is committed to taking people off the streets and into homeless hostels. However, many homeless people appear to prefer spending nights in doorways and relying on the generosity of passers-by or soup runs. Considering the fact that they support £250,000 to be spent on nasty advertisements instead of helping homeless people directly, I don't blame people for avoiding the Salvation Army. I have to add that editorial comment. Since 1998, the number of rough sleepers in England at any one time is estimated to have fallen from 1,850 to 1,180, and that sounds like a vast underestimate. The government is committed to cutting the number by two-thirds by the end of 2002, requiring a further reduction of 580 a target the DETR says it is on course to reach. And we have an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it was Norway or Finland or Sweden, but one of those three finger countries, they have a program. It's a card, and you can actually give that card to somebody, and that represents a portion of a hotel fee.
Mm-hmm.
And some have full hotel fee on them for individuals that are like that find themselves without a place to stay.
Hmm. Interesting.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think they have the same thing in Montana and the Dakotas.
Interesting.
Because I know that in the Dakotas, during the winter months, you can't get kicked out for not paying your rent, because of the fact that if you can't get to work because of the snow and you can't pay your rent, then it's inhumane to kick you out.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. If you can get more specifics on it, I'd love to look into that.
Yeah, I'd like to figure out which one it was. God, I want to say Norway.
Well, I know we had in Santa Cruz. I mean, we could contrast that what they were trying to do here about 5 or 6 years ago with their little spare change, real change, not spare change cards for the homeless program.
But that didn't actually provide any monetary.
No. It actually provided misinformation. It
said,
call this number and you'll get help. And
right.
Of course,
and all you get is an answering machine.
Exactly.
Like an answering machine is really helpful to somebody on the street.
It just takes. It's helpful to the phone company. It gives them 35 cents, I guess.
Right. It would call 911 if it's an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then 911 comes out, and then the city gets from the, we got to answer to every damn homeless person call.
Or if you're mentally ill and you call 911 in San Jose, they might do you the favor of putting you out of your misery.
Yeah.
A couple of bullets.
Oh,
has been done.
Definitely.
Or in Monterey.
Off as a,
or Seaside.
Oh, frequent caller. He's a frequent crazy caller, so we'll just leave it at that. No investigation needed.
Yeah, well, I know that Charles Vaughn Jr. was senior was shot on the roof of a seaside home after 911 got called, and his crime was not responding to the pepper spraying of an officer on the roof. The officer on the ground said, "Cap."
Here's a likely scenario. Mm-hmm. I just lost my place, man. My credit hit the roof. I'm just down on my luck, man. First night out on the streets. I figure the best place to sleep is over in this area. After the night, I hear a few crack deals going on beside me. I really don't mind that much. I can sleep through it. I'm so tired, right? So I wake up in the middle of the night, stumble around, hopefully find an outside toilet. But if I can't, then a bush will do just fine. And I hear, I see a light. I look out. Oh, man, it's those crack dealers again. I better run. Turn, run, get shot. Oops, it was a cop.
Yeah, I don't know. That doesn't happen frequently in Santa Cruz, but it certainly has happened in that kind of scenario has happened in New York and Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's a so could have it did. You know?
41 bullets for Amadeo Diallo for essentially reaching for his wallet.
Yeah. With the brass tacks of it, I wish it would the homeless issue would hit a national attention, because there's other countries, South Africa, their housing condition is appalling, and they got celebrities speaking on that. Well, you know, when you look into America, it's appalling to me that it gets that cold shoulder. I mean, no pun intended, but
right.
it's a serious matter.
Right.
You know?
I hear you.
That's why it's important for people to bring their blankets to the blanket drive at the needle exchange there.
And also important to come to the protest on November 28th at City Council at 6:30.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Robert, keep up the crusade, and I hope your aim is true. Because some people do question your aim sometimes.
Hey, my aim is not always the best, but I keep firing.
Yeah, you're consistent. Yeah. I got to give you that, Robert.
Hey.
I do believe that if anybody can argue that you are that you're not consistent, then call 427-FRSC.
Fair
enough. Voice your opinion.
Yeah, man.
He's not Rush. He won't cut you off and put you in a sound box.
Usually not.
Nah, not you.
Hey.
All right.
Thank you.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
I am just an atom, and my story's seldom told. I have squandered nanoseconds on a campaign full of mumbles, such are promises. It's all rhetoric, still a proton likes electrons, and they offered me a deal, oh Lila. In the manufactured Cold War, they told me I was the best, that I'd fight for truth and justice, and they sure loved my wave particle duality. I was naive, I agreed to speak with neutrons that were waiting in the hole. I was mighty proud, feeling several angstroms tall. It works just like the sun, except that lots of people die. It's an instrument of peace, except that all it does is feed our loaded war machine. Free energy, yeah, except for all the startup costs and cleanup costs and storage costs and healthcare costs and environmental costs and political costs and cultural costs and emotional costs and sociological costs
and agricultural
and
costs
and security costs, aesthetic costs,
military costs,
re-educational costs,
mediation costs.
I asked only for a reason. I went looking for some sense, but I got no answers. Just a dogmatic waffling about security. They ought to face the peacetime dividend was spent.
Phone here at 5:05 on Thursday afternoon, November 9th, with Linda LeMaster of Housing Now in Santa Cruz, formerly the chair of the Homeless Issues Task Force, and a person very much concerned with homeless issues for the last two decades. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Yeah, you make me sound important. I'm also a person who's been a homeless parent and a homeowner in this town.
As well as a frequent caller to Bathrob Spears Broadsides.
Oh, I pick on other shows, too.
Yeah. Well, I know that you've been following the election pretty closely. You've actually kept your eye on the 15 candidates, and we now have winners in the city council races. Do you have any comments?
About the winners?
Yeah.
No, I mean, the outcome looks like a pretty clear message from the people of this city that they want people they already know.
You mean talking Scott Kennedy and Mark Premack?
Yeah, and Emily Riley,
yeah. And I guess the last one was Ed Porter, who's also another old-time.
Yeah.
He's been around for a number of years.
So he's made it a point of getting well-known.
Uh-huh. He certainly I think it's his third or fourth election.
I know he's run two other times, but I'm not a good source of numerical stuff.
Well, I know one of your candidates, Scott Kennedy, has won, and many of us are aghast. What's your reaction?
You make me feel like a mother hen here. He's not my candidate, but he's a friend of mine, and he's someone I can approach, and he's someone that I feel has put a lot into this neighborhood I live in, which the bureaucrats call the Lower Ocean neighborhood for the sake of getting more federal dollars or something.
Police, guns, favors to the Seaside Company. What else are we thinking of?
Just well, some of the housing money. This is one neighborhood, and the Beach Flats is the other, where the city can actually offer people who are low-income poor but have clean enough credit to purchase a house. The city can help underwrite their purchase by providing a grant for a down payment.
Is that happening?
You have to live in these two neighborhoods that are, you know, technically or legalistically blighted.
Mm-hmm. Now, has that happened much?
Well, no. Who do you know that's poor enough to qualify but rich enough to be able to convince a mortgager?
I'm just wondering.
Sort of like taking the people off the top of the bottom of the pit.
Is it meaningful or is it just a spurious gesture?
I don't think it's spurious, but I'm just saying it's a difficult small spectrum of people who could actually realize that.
And you don't know it.
Until we set up something like the old RIMS, Rental Information and Mediation Service, and stuff like the Tenants Congress is doing to help people clean up their credit reports who have been renters, too few people can access that kind of support.
So you don't know of any...
We have pieces of a program, but we don't have a
Linda,
whole...
Linda, you don't know of anybody who's actually used this program in your neighborhood?
No.
Is that correct?
Right.
Okay, just wondering. I'm sorry.
I looked into it myself, but I have terrible credit, and I have a disability for an income, and the banks that supposedly are handling these loans told me I'd have to at least triple my income.
Well,
so it's not as viable as, say, Habitat for Humanity, but for somebody that, like maybe an elderly person on an adequate pension, it'd be the only way they would have to get in a place, you know. Because if you're on a fixed income, how are you going to save up to 10 or more percent of what housing costs here for a down payment and even finance it, let alone get the payments within your income?
So it looks like a sort of a not necessarily overwhelming... Did you say Kennedy was responsible for this?
No. I mean, I think Kennedy was on the council, in fact, when they started setting it up. But I wouldn't credit any one council member. I think it's probably more of a staff accomplishment. It's something that any city that declares blighted neighborhoods could apply for and get the funds.
Well, let's get off this one because I think we've covered it. Are you happy that Kennedy is now in power here? I mean, he's... a lot
I'm
of us
relieved.
Are not.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not jumping for joy at any of them, but I'm relieved. I see the council as being more pedestrian or mainstream than it was before the election. But I wasn't too happy with our former new guys, if you know what I mean.
So you feel that Rotkin, Hernandez, Matthews, and Byers were further out and less mainstream than the current people that just came in?
Well, let's say when they first got on the council, they were, you know, there's a thing that happens when you're on the city council where you might get insulated from the reality of people who aren't on the council who have to actually sweat to make a living and such. And, Dean, you know as well as I do, Catherine was more concerned, more humanitarian, more concerned about poor people when she first got on, just to pull one example. Rodkin was admitted... feminist socialist when he first got on, which was a long time ago. I mean, they're not the people they were the first time they got elected.
1979, that was many years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
But and what I'm saying is, well, people's lives have gotten more desperate and more willing to be innovative. The council is sort of getting more neutralized.
So you're not talking about the council that left, you're talking about the council many years ago is what you're talking about.
No, I'm saying the council... You know, I was actually trying to criticize the new guys from the last election, the mayor and the soon-to-be mayor.
Oh, I see.
You know, I don't have any specific criticism of Chris Krohn, but as a team, I feel the council we have right now doesn't look before they leap.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking about a sort of systemic problem, or maybe it's a simple matter of they need more education or more experience. I don't know. But I don't think our new guys that just got elected are going to make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
But it is likely to make...
Well, I know that the old council took a lot of its cues from Michael Rotkin, who made many of the motions that the city council voted for. Now we have the return of Scott, sit on the sidewalk, go to jail, Kennedy, who passed the downtown ordinances and led when he was mayor around that issue. Do you think that similarly he will be the person that the city council looks to for a guidance?
Similar to Mike Rotkin, I think their styles are radically different. I suppose if he wanted to, he could put himself in the place of being the old guy that knows stuff. That's certainly what he did during the campaigning, but I'm looking at it a different way. It's like, are the new people we have more capable of getting things done than they are of putting foot in mouth?
Getting what things done?
Anything that they attempt.
So what things do you think they're going to attempt? Well, let me put it this way. I don't... You wanted to go there. What things do you want them to attempt?
Thank you. I appreciate the distinction. I want to talk right now about Measure U, because that's a nice segue to one thing I'd like to see them do.
Mm-hmm. Measure U is, of course, Catherine Byers' drip drop. We won't do anything for 2 years on the Homeless Issues Task Force, but we will do a $600,000 a year ballot measure, which we could have also done out of the general fund, but chose not to for 2 years. And we get defeated by, I guess, not by just 2%, but by, I guess they had to get two-thirds or something.
Yeah, they had to get something like two-thirds of a vote.
Right.
And they got a simple majority, but that doesn't mean anything when it comes to big numbers.
This was a measure that talked about a family shelter, and this was her big deal. In fact, she could have saved us all a lot of time and energy by just passing it. She had the votes to pass it at city council.
Well, what if she didn't feel like she wanted to pass it? She didn't want to be remembered for doing something that, pardon the phrase, radical, and that's why it got put on the ballot. They wanted sort of a thermometer reading rather than to do anything.
Oh, I don't think it's a what if. I'm sure that could well be the case. But the fact of the matter is
that
shows...
Well, you can assert it. I can only guess.
Right. Well, you can only guess, and I will assert it, and I will say that that's what she did, and apparently had she really wanted to do it, she could have done it with her four votes, but she didn't.
As far as I'm concerned, that's what they all did.
Byers controlled the council. She was the shadow mayor of that council. They didn't do shit without looking at her.
Yeah,
I'm afraid that's the reality.
I can see your point, but a minute ago you said the same thing sort of about Mike Rotkin. What I want to talk about is what we can do to get a family shelter and other kinds of shelter. You know, I'm not talking about full service plumbing.
Go ahead, Linda. You're talking about shelter for the,
shelter
for those without shelter, senators.
Shelter for all kinds of people. The numbers of people becoming homeless are growing because the gap is widening between who has money and who has no access whatsoever to what we call the mainstream, which includes jobs. That is well documented here in Santa Cruz County as well as in general.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, we are doing less about housing that people who live here can afford, who work, let alone people who've had a hard time. So the context I want you and your listeners to think about right now is shelter in the most basic sense that you can imagine it. You know, like the one where Jesus was born? It was
mm-hmm.
a barn. His mattress was straw. The animals had to move over to make room for these people.
Well, I know that the city council has refused to expand shelter in any meaningful way other than with this whole very expensive community Paige Smith transitional program, where they actually cut back on shelter. If you consider the open-air shelter they were closing down, the only campground. And I know Kennedy has been a big opponent of any campground, though everybody always likes to talk about how they favor shelter, and I think the city council candidates, most of them, except for Premack and Kennedy, if you include Porter and Riley, said they wanted to see safe sleeping places, although Riley went through this flip-flop, disaffiliating herself from an activist agenda. She's not an activist. I guess she just lets the staff make her decisions. I don't know what she quite meant by what she said.
She didn't either, and I'll find out together.
I think what she meant, I think we know she hasn't, by midsummer she had not yet read the sleeping ban camping ordinance that she had been officially advising the mayor on, so I dread to think of what we have in store for us, but let's hope that I'm eating the wrong
chocolate. I've got a couple hours to talk about this, and I got a couple minutes.
You better go ahead.
What I want to say is, and anybody with a piece of brain at all should be able to see this, this is not an either-or dilemma, you know? Building a shelter for families with little kids is not an alternative to providing a place where people don't get tickets if they fall asleep in the vehicle, which is their only shelter. And vehicular parking is not an alternative for people who have their blankets stolen if they have to go do something in the daytime or get arrested at night if they get caught asleep. These are all aspects of a problem that will continue to grow until our communities get real and get more honest. And when people see that this is their nieces and nephews and children and grandchildren that are being destroyed and that are dying prematurely and that are getting sick with things like tuberculosis and staph for no good reason, when people realize that, they're going to do something with or without the leadership of the city council. Meanwhile, we got this council we're going to have to deal with. But I think that putting Measure U on the ballot was a cheap shot, even for these councils we like to criticize. But that kind of money is what we need for seed money to build a shelter that would be adequate to get a family from being homeless to being housed in some way. But it's one little link. It's a link in a chain that's deadly if we don't build it. And we need, you know, where does the person who has worked their way into a family shelter, because that probably means six families at max, the kind of money they talked about in Measure U, after they've accomplished getting back on their feet, then where do they move?
Well, you know, there isn't
an answer that's adequate. The government, the federal government has said, issue more Section 8 vouchers, which is a kind of subsidy, which they keep raising the percent the renter or tenant has to pay so that they could spread it around a little farther without really feeling it anymore. But Linda, they didn't fund it.
Linda, we have four city council members who just got into office. We have winter approaching.
There is
a phone number, 420-5017, that anyone can call to tell these city council members what they should be doing in the next 2 months. Tell them, please, what should they be doing?
What I'm trying to say is immediately, not within the next few months, within by their first seated meeting where they can vote, they need to set up the funding mechanism. They need to invite everyone in the community rather than punish one little segment of merchants to participate in a bond, which would be the long-term financing for this. And meanwhile, like you were saying a few minutes ago, they need to put some city money out of the general fund up to start this family shelter. And meanwhile, look at the other gaps in any kind of a shelter system. And every time somebody dies, and every time I hear about someone else I've met committing suicide, I get more enraged. So forgive me, and I hope this council can, if I'm a little impatient with them. But these are easy-to-do things. You do not have to have a defensive, reactionary response to your own citizenry.
So in other words, your priority for them is to kind of fund Measure U type stuff themselves immediately.
What I'm saying is, before their second meeting, where the new guys can vote, they should have the beginning of a plan that will provide at least four kinds of shelter that don't exist or that exist in a tokenistic way now in our city.
What are those four kinds?
Well, what I was just talking about. We need a family shelter, which means it's a place that's safe for young children and a place where people that have been kicking around outside can shift from the day-to-day reality into the month-to-month reality that will get them eventually in housing. We need housing. We need co-ops and affordable underwritten housing like Mercy Charities' predecessor was supposed to be developing and has developed some of. We need enough for the population that we know in the city needs it. We need places that people can park whose only resources are vehicles, if the vehicles, in fact, can shelter them. And we need mass shelters in every neighborhood. Is that four?
What about people who don't want to go into these little shelters?
Well, I'm not necessarily talking little, but...
Big shelters. That is the majority of homeless people out there. Well, I don't know if it's the majority. Certainly a significant number who are camping tonight in the old Pogo Nip. What do you suggest for them?
Put the Rangers on Horses back out there so that there's some interaction and humanity between the people that are camping there and the people that aren't. So the people that are camping there don't have to hide from the people that are going up there just to get drunk or exploit the homeless.
So you think the campers like those rangers on their horses, huh?
Some campers do and some campers don't. People are parked out there or tented out there for different reasons. I'm not an anarchist, Robert, you know that.
Are you aware that it is currently a $54 fine if you raise a tent in the Pogo Nip, and if you keep it up, it's a misdemeanor punishable by a $1,000 fine and 6 months in jail?
I didn't know that's the misdemeanor part.
Oh, yeah. That's the
you
case.
Know
that's called the,
that stuff
you may
at?
Have heard of it. That's called the camping ban. It's been a law in Santa Cruz since 1978. What do you suggest
these... You know anybody that's got that $1,000 fine and 6 months?
They've never taken a person to a misdemeanor trial. No.
Okay. Because if that happens, we don't have to fiddle around with this stupid city council stuff. We can go straight to court.
What I'm saying to you is you are somehow proposing that... I'm not quite sure what you're proposing for the majority of homeless people. I've
I'm
heard
not
talk
proposing
about
any one thing. I don't have it in my mind
right.
that the majority of homeless people fit any one set of behaviors or needs.
Uh-huh. Well, the majority of homeless people are outdoors right now, and you're
yes.
suggesting...
And I'm saying there's a lot of different kinds of indoors, or at least under a roof... Even if it's their own car or truck.
Linda, I'm asking, I guess I'm feeling a little frustrated here. I'm asking for you to tell the audience, if you can, what they should do, what they should tell 420-5017. Should they just say, fund measure U type shelters, please, before Christmas, which isn't going to do anything because they won't.
No, absolutely.
What exactly, I'm not quite sure, what do you want this council to hear from the public?
I think the council needs to hear from homeless people a little bit. I guess what I want to say to them, this might fit for other people in the public, is that we need four or five kinds of shelter, and we need it now, and these people are not going to go away, and their corpses are going to come in as reminders.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I don't have a buddy in the morgue, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of concern has been raised about the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I thought everybody would tell me my position on that, that criminalizing people for unnecessary action.
Well, you haven't suggested...
unconstitutional.
I haven't heard you suggest people call in and talk about that. That's
no, that's not what we're talking about.
Right.
You asked my view
right, no,
of
I
the
know.
Election,
yeah.
And my view of the election is that Measure U was a cop-out by the council's new guys from 2 years ago. And we need to throw that away, start over, and get real.
Well, actually, Measure U, which proposed an increase in the transient occupancy tax to fund a family shelter to the tune of $600,000 a year, was almost from the first to the last a Catherine Byers measure where she insisted on four council meetings within 1 week to talk about this Proposition U.
Well,
so I don't really agree with
maybe
you.
Maybe you're right, and it's a
yeah.
one-woman deal. I don't
right.
know that. I fought the whole council. I find fault with the whole city council that's sitting right now for doing something that's so dirty and underhanded. And if Catherine led it, or if she swept up as a...
Well, you haven't clarified to our...
Me.
You haven't clarified to our listeners why it's dirty and underhanded, and frankly...
I have, but you weren't listening.
No, I didn't... I don't
I said it was ill-conceived and reactionary, and it can't work that way.
Right, well, those are interesting words, but they don't really tell us about that. But I don't really want to go into a measure that's failed. I would prefer... I would prefer to ask, what do you want the council to do in the first... Well, you say the first session, that's fine. I'd like to see them have a program, too. But as a woman who has been on the scene for 20 years and housing now in Santa Cruz...
And had camping tickets.
And had many camping tickets and friends who have many more camping tickets. What do you think that the citizenry should do now to get the council to do something?
I think the council would be motivated if a lot of people showed up in person and made phone calls. I don't think that's going to happen, but that doesn't mean the council couldn't choose to take the right step. Obviously, decriminalizing sleep should be at the top of the list. It's an obscenity, and it's unconstitutional both to the state and the federal constitution.
Yeah.
And people who don't know that need merely to read those constitutions as well as the ordinance forbidding sleep in public after dark or after, what is it, 11?
After 11, yeah.
Yeah. Are easy to get hold of.
We've been talking to Linda LeMaster. I should say we've been bullying poor Linda LeMaster here.
Well, your bullying is not what makes me poor.
No, okay. Well, I want to thank you for putting up with it. And is there anything you want to add before we move along?
Yeah. I really, maybe I hold the city council electeds to a higher standard than some guy I don't know I met on the street corner. But I'm sick of hearing people throw out one idea as a defense to keep from having to think about another idea. If people are homeless, they need different things, and we are a city that has the resources right now. They're throwing away money to meet all those needs. And the only way we're going to meet them is let the people who have those needs say what they are instead of treating them like things, like corpses or something.
Thank you, Linda LeMaster, and I encourage you to call City Council at 420-5017 after you finish this interview and tell them what you told us.
I'm going to put it in writing, and I hope a lot of people do call. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you. Hello, caller.
Yeah, hi, Robert. This is Becky. Becky Johnson calling in.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted a very interesting conversation there with Linda LeMaster about, you know, all the different types of sheltered needs that seem imminently important to any of us who are looking at this. I also wanted to add that when she was breaking up different groups, teen homelessness is one group, and also another group would be a wet shelter of some kind for people who are actively using drug and alcohol, and you know, they're not going to quit tomorrow, but they do need to be sheltered. But anyway, I'm calling because of my television show. I have a little television show on community television in Santa Cruz County, Robert.
I've heard about that one.
Yeah, it's on Channel 27 for those of free radio audience that actually have access to a television set and cable and all that. But we have a show coming up this Tuesday that is scooping CBS's 48 Hours.
Wow.
We have a topic and some guests. They're going to be covering this in January. This is a case of Steve and Madeline Miller, who are pharmacists up in Redding, California, and their co-worker, Dr. Frank Fisher, who were on your radio show a few weeks back, Robert.
I remember. That's Dr. Foster and the Yabagas.
Yeah.
I kept calling them by the wrong name. But, yeah, they were a great set of interviewees, and they're facing trial, I guess, in January.
Yeah, this pharmacist, Steve Miller, and his wife, Madeline, a local doctor from Redding, California, were prescribing needed medications for low-income and indigent patients billed through California's Medi-Cal program. When nearly 90 patients were denied payment for needed medications, Steve and Madeline Miller, along with Dr. Frank Fisher, helped them to file appeals, which they expected to win since they knew what the law said. Instead, however, the DEA staged a commando raid, arresting the Millers and Dr. Fisher, seizing all the medical records for the 90 patients, and jailing the Millers and Dr. Fisher for drug trafficking and for several counts of murder. I think there were some other charges in there, too, as well. Lacking any papers related to their cases, none of the 90 patients were able to prevail at their hearings. Now, the host of the show is that yours, it's you, Robert Norris.
Oh, well, in which case I'll have to watch that show.
Yeah, you have to watch yourself. Interview the Millers and Dr. Fish. And this is kind of unusual for Club Cruise. This will be the only airing of this show because we had to, in order for it to get the Millers and Dr. Fisher on the show, we had to agree not to air it any more than our one airing. Actually, it'd be two airings, Tuesday and Thursday, 7 p.m. on Channel 27.
That'll be coming up in 2 days and then again on Thursday.
That's right. And if you want a copy, boys, get your somebody with a VCR and set it and make a copy, because that's
this could be an heirloom. You could hand it to your grandchildren. Or possibly to a DEA agent, who knows?
Well, and the Millers and Dr. Fisher face trial coming up in Redding, California in January. I think that there were five counts of murder that have been dropped back to manslaughter.
they're claiming, of course, that these people, by giving them pain medications, killed them, right?
One thing that Dr. Fisher did was he gave chronic, intractable pain patients sufficient doses of opiate-related medications to take care of their, medicate their pain. And that was the basis that the DEA used to say that they were drug trafficking. Actually, you know, a medical doctor and a pharmacist, you know, are legal drug traffickers. And they were also watching what was going on in the California legislature regarding laws relative to opium and opiate derivatives, which they believe are very helpful to people in pain and really one of the best medications with one of the fewest side effects. The fears of addiction in chronic intractable pain patients has been highly overrated. And so Dr. Fisher was prescribing, filling out these triplicate forms for these opiate-related medications. Some of them were quite expensive, and there appeared to be a problem with the Medi-Cal program that just didn't want to cough up the money for low-income and homeless patients who needed these medications. And so, you know, they were really on the front lines there with the homeless people and getting them the medical care they needed.
Well, I hope that folks do tune in, those who have cable TV, unlike myself. But that's Channel 27 on Tuesday and Thursday nights, these coming Tuesday and Thursday at 7 o'clock.
November 21st and November 23rd.
Hey. Well, thank you, Becky. Anything you want to add?
You may remember the Millers and Dr. Fisher because they spoke at the Shadow Convention in Los Angeles last August.
And more important, they spoke on Bathroom Spears Broadsides about a month ago.
Actually, Free Radio scooped Club Cruise, which scoops 48 hours.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Bye.
And this is Free Radio 96.3 FM. I'm Bathroom Spear Robert Norse, and the call-in number is 427-3772 as we enter the last 14 minutes of this twice-weekly show. We'll be coming back to you Thursday, 6 to 8 in the evening, and then again on Sunday at 11 o'clock in the morning. We have been losing homeless people at quite a clip. I've mentioned five people have died, either through hangings where they supposedly hung themselves. I've not gotten clear indication, finally, of the coroner's report. I'm assuming these are suicides. One was a man named Steve who hung himself near Highway 9. Another, more recently, a man named Michael Cassidy was found hung in San Lorenzo Park on October 23rd. Boxer Bill Dennison died on Lee Brandt Street last week, frozen to death in a carport, although I guess the cause of death was not officially determined by the coroner. And then there were two overdoses last week, one of alcohol and one of methamphetamine / LSD is what I've been told, though again I haven't read official reports. So they're dropping like flies out there. It's time to really get it together to come to the November 28th protest at City Council at 6:30, and then consider putting in some time methodically to step up the pressure regularly during this very crucial Christmas, Thanksgiving to Christmas season, where merchants are particularly vulnerable to economic pressure, and presumably the City Council, through the merchants, is also vulnerable to that pressure, if that's the road that these protests take. And it's still not too clear. I mean, the City Council could sort of sidestep all this protest by actually, what a concept, doing something early on. We don't expect that'll happen, but who knows? You know, I'm always hopeful. We want to give these people a chance to do that. And that's why, I guess, Tuesday morning at 7:30 in the morning, for all you early birds, come on down to Tastings Restaurant in the Holiday Inn. The Homeless Working Group will be meeting there, kind of hammering out its final proposal to City Council members in hopes that the next day, on Wednesday, they'll put it on the agenda for Tuesday, November 28th, and we'll actually get somewhere. We can all join together in a happy celebration instead of a fractious protest. You never can tell what will happen. Here's a couple of quick stories. Here's one from High Times. Dick Cheney, Russian oil, and Asian heroin. By the time you've read this, former Defense Secretary Richard Cheney may be America's vice president, yet investigators have now tied the Russian oil deals he helped arrange to financial sleaze in the former Soviet Union's booming drug trade. Cheney is CEO of Halliburton, a top global energy services contractor, and has swung clout in Washington for high-stakes projects in the oil-rich Caspian Sea region. Last year, when the U.S. Export-Import Bank guaranteed $489 million in loans to Russia's Tynuman Oil Company, the Moscow Times identified Cheney as the key power broker in procuring the money. The State Department halted the Ex-Im Bank's guarantees after TNK's aggressive takeover of a subsidiary of Russian oil major Sadanko, burning the company's major foreign shareholder, BP Amoco, which complained to the White House and Congress. BP Amoco is said to have turned its own investigation into TNK over to the CIA for perusal. But, wrote the Moscow Times' Catherine Belton, TNK had a few tricks up its sleeve, and one of them was Dick Cheney. $292 million of the guarantee was slated for buying equipment from Halliburton to develop TNK's Samotior oil field. It is a common knowledge that the CEO of Halliburton took a number of major steps in order to get the guarantees, TNK official Andrei Krivortov told Belton. A new report by Washington Center for Public Integrity now links a major TNK shareholder, Russia's Rifa Group, with Central Asian drug trafficking. Rifa Group hotly denies the claims, but the center quotes a U.S. intelligence report based on an interview with an unidentified ex-KGB agent as saying that Rifa Bank and its trading arm, Rifa Eco, were deeply involved in the early 1990s laundering of Russian and Colombian money and the trafficking of drugs from the Far East to Europe. In 1997, Russian parliamentarian Viktor Ilyukin called upon the Interior Ministry to investigate Alpha, charging it participated in the transit of drugs from Southeast Asia through Russia and into Europe. He also cited sources in the FSB, successor agency to the KGB. So again, this is an article in the High Witness, High Times News, High Witness News section of December, linking Richard Cheney, who is, of course, the vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party, as CEO of Halliburton, with hanky-panky around Russia's Tynuman Oil Company and drug money. I, frankly, wish I'd read that more carefully before I troubled you with it. It's not as clear as it could be. We'll try to do a little more pre-broadcast screening in the future. A couple more announcements. There is no city council meeting this week, per se, except for a strange 8:30 a.m. closed session on Tuesday. That's the litigation session of City Council, where actually probably a lot of the real business of City Council gets done illegally, I might add. I'm, of course, just doing a little shotgun firing here because I don't have the smoking gun. But I have heard sort of secondary indications from inside sources that City Council violates the Brown Act by talking about items behind closed doors that it shouldn't be doing. Dirty business, so to speak. Closed session is supposed to be only for litigation, lawsuits, and personnel matters. Otherwise, everything they talk about should be open to the public. But this administration, the Sugar administration we might call it, has not been too friendly to that, nor, frankly, was the Kennedy administration. When Kennedy was in power, even the Byers administration was not terribly excited about it. So we saw things like Sugar trying to hold a closed-door meeting of his Citizens Police Review Board City Council subcommittee, and when we frustrated that by simply marching into the meeting and saying, this is an open meeting, he closed it down, dissolved the meeting, and wouldn't hold another meeting for 6 months. And his successor, Arnie Leff, Citizens Police Review Board head, who heads this subcommittee, has likewise refused to hold another meeting, even though we are now after the elections, and he has no excuse whatsoever, except that he apparently doesn't want to do anything or doesn't want to do anything until after January when new commission appointments are made. However, of course, police abuse does not wait. It continues every day, as John Telfair, the elderly man harassed by a female police officer downtown for holding up a sign that said, you know, please donate, found out. And as we will all be finding out, I'm afraid, one way or another, or certainly some of us will be finding out. So we need to press on with these issues. City Council meets at 8:30 on Tuesday. If you want to go to the closed session, you'll be allowed to speak in the open interval before the closed session. And, of course, we did a lot of talking around the Dolphin Lee issue when that happened. Those are the apartments which where Hispanic people essentially are in the Dolphin. Although I understand they haven't been evicted yet, and I haven't got hard stats on that, but I did speak to a Dolphin tenant yesterday just in passing as I ran into him at one of the service jobs in a downtown restaurant. He told me that they had signed the contracts. The city, Mercy Charities Housing, the group controlling now the Dolphin apartments, has presented the contracts to all the tenants for them to sign. Apparently that signing has happened. We haven't yet gotten a copy of the contract to find out what the tenants are signing on to. And, of course, the problem at City Council that we found last month when they rushed this thing through was that there is no clear legal guarantee that everybody who currently lives there will be allowed to continue. Michael Rotkin, council member, assured us there was. Elizabeth Vogel of Mercy Charities Housing, the group that's running and now has purchased the property, or I'm not sure, escrow probably has already closed. I haven't gotten the final word on that. I guess they probably have purchased it because the contracts have been signed. I'm assuming they've purchased it. They were given $1.5 million by City Council in a low, no-interest, long-term loan to be converted into a grant they could spend to buy this property and then to run their low-income housing project. They gave no guarantees legally that people would not be evicted immediately for space problems or other problems. And more important, they gave no guarantees that the people who are currently living in these apartment complexes, all of them Latino, many of them undocumented, a lot of them poor, almost all of them poor, I would imagine, would have a real opportunity to return to the low-income housing project or real alternate housing. And there's been some kind of bigoted nativist criticism. You can see a kind of a flyer out by a guy called Jerry Simpson. There's a thing called Loose Cannon. You'll see this one-page flyer. You can pick it up in the Saturn Cafe. It denounces Latinos for getting special benefits. So why should they? These illegal people get special benefits? And it's not that they should get special benefits. It is rather that if the city is going to go in and destroy their housing and put up a low-income housing project, it shouldn't do so without making sure that they have some equivalent place to go to where they could pay the same rent. Just tearing down their housing for a little show project and a project that does some good for those who happen to get into it, although to which they don't have too much input, and it is run by an organization that a lot of them repudiated, Mercy Charities Housing, shouldn't be done without making sure that the people you're dislodging don't have other housing to go to. It doesn't mean you have to pay for their housing, but it means you don't destroy their current housing. That's something that Jerry Simpson of Loose Cannon hasn't seemed to have picked up on yet. Perhaps he will at some point. Well, we're nearly at the end of Bathrop Spears' broadsides, but the little red hen seems to be stuck in the hen house. At least she hasn't. The two hens have not yet clucked their way up the steps, so they should be coming here soon, and we're reaching the end of our rope, end of our show. A couple of other quick announcements. The SCAN Steering Committee, Santa Cruz Action Network, the group that was supporting, we were having a fight to make sure that they supported ending the sleeping ban, which they did, but then they haven't done anything about it, and they support the rights of the tenants, but then some key people in the Central Steering Committee disaffiliated themselves from the very good television forum that we did on the Dolphin Lee project. That was Nora Hockman and Bernice Belton, who were kind of at the center of the SCAN organization. They dissolved the housing committee. I was barred from SCAN headquarters. This whole series of kind of rapid-fire moves taken largely behind closed doors. Mediation, they've refused to mediate on this issue. We started a petition to set up another SCAN general membership meeting where we could actually vote on it. They had a special quick session, a quick general membership meeting where the names of the people who were in the steering committee were printed on the ballot, but the rest of us who tried to run weren't put on the ballot, and they didn't. Extremely irregular voting procedures is what it boils down to. We talked about that before. We have heard nothing from them since then, so we're still looking to get some satisfaction in the court of public opinion as well as before the general membership. There's some interesting stuff coming up in San Francisco. I was reading on San Francisco Liberation Radio's website that there were apparently some good interviews with homeless people. I'm hoping to have these replayed in a future show. There's also coming up Young Voices Speak Out on Poverty and the Homeless, a conference, December 2nd, 11 a.m. to 5 at the Mission High School in San Francisco, put on by the National Coalition for the Homeless, San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness, Mayor's Office of Homelessness, San Francisco United School District, Poor Magazine, and many others. One item up for discussion is a homeless curriculum created by the National Coalition for the Homeless that is expected to be implemented. And let's see, what else have we got here? And it's going to be, I'm giving you more information about that. The reason I'm interested in this particularly is because I think the focus on children, homeless children in Santa Cruz, is one that we have not really gotten into at City Council or in the public eye, and that's something that I think can have a potent effect on public opinion, and should have a potent effect on public opinion. We're going to be talking about that as we proceed. A brief musical break, and I think we'll probably be leaving the air, but if the red hand doesn't show, we'll continue a little bit longer and hope that we can. Hope we don't lay an egg while we're doing that.
Or pollute the air you breathe. Oh no. I only wanted to make a lot of money, but now you're blaming my factory for your sickness and the acid rain. Acid rain, acid rain. The EPA, they'll say it's clean. Just as soon as I ain't your own lip, poor communities of color, so who cares about your acid rain?
Elections, of course, Kate Canlis being the DA.
Uh-huh. That helps.
All right. And I think it needs to be said, too, in an objective sense, if we're going to play...